From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Six mountain gorillas were murdered, actually executed, last summer in their sanctuary, the Congo's Virunga National Park. Photojournalist Brent Sturton was there when the primates' bodies were discovered. His photo, published in Newsweek, sparked outrage around the world. He recently returned to the park with reporter Mark Jenkins for the story, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas?, the cover story of the new edition of National Geographic. On today's Fresh Air, Sturton talks about the gorilla massacre and the larger story it's part of, the war in the Congo and the aftermath of the Rwanda genocide. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new tribute to Keith Jarrett by drummer George Shuler. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why were 6 mountain gorillas, primates threatened with extinction, executed last July in their sanctuary in the Congo's Virunga National Park? The answer is a microcosm of the war in the Congo and the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, involving brutal militias, corruption, smuggling, and an environmental nightmare. My guest, Bren Sturton, took an amazing photo for Newsweek last year that brought global attention to the gorilla massacre. It was a picture of a dead 500-pound male named Senkwekwe, tied on its back to a stretcher made out of sapling branches. Over a dozen African men are carrying Senkwekwe out of the park. When Sturton took that photo last July, he wanted to find out who murdered the gorillas and why. He recently got his chance to investigate when he became the first photojournalist allowed back into the part of the park where the mountain gorillas live, a section of the park now controlled by a militia. With Sturton was reporter Mark Jenkins. They have the cover story in the new edition of the National Geographic, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? A companion documentary will be shown July 1st on the National Geographic channel. You can see Sturton's photos on our website, freshair.npr.org. And I want to give you this heads up. Our conversation will contain some brief descriptions of animal cruelty, which some listeners may find too disturbing to listen to. Bren Sturton, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, when I first saw the picture, and I didn't know the story yet, but I just saw the picture of this large mountain gorilla being carried on a pallet by a group of African men, I thought, this is such an amazing picture. I don't even know, are these people who murdered the gorilla? Are these people who are trying to give the gorilla a burial? Is this some kind of strange ritual? Like, what is going on here? But you just kind of freeze in your tracks seeing the photo.
Sure. I understand it's a surreal image. A lot of people have said to me that they thought it was a film still, that they didn't think it was a real moment. It's a complex image, but what you are watching is the very empathetic and respectful evacuation of these animals by local villagers and local conservation rangers. They were removing the gorillas from the area where they were slaughtered and to a place where they can be taken for examination.
6 gorillas were killed in that massacre, 7 if you count the gorilla that was being carried by the pregnant female who was killed. How were these gorillas killed? Like, what were the ways that they were massacred?
These gorillas were killed late in the evening. They were killed just in the final light, and they were shot by AK-47. On average, these gorillas sustained at least 3 to 5 rounds each. One of the female gorillas, the gorilla that was pregnant and a couple of months away from giving birth, was in fact also burnt in a sort of final sadistic act.
You describe these as executions. Mm-hmm. How did you know that they were executions as opposed to, say, poachers?
We know that these were executions because we know that from prior poaching incidents involving gorillas that they would normally take the head or the hands or at the very least a degree of bush meat from these creatures. On average, they would be looking for the infants, which they would be trying to sell. There's always been some degree of market for infant gorillas, though it's not known that any infant mountain gorillas have ever survived those kind of transactions. The fact that these gorillas were simply killed and left in the forest ensured for us that there was some kind of statement going on here, that this just wasn't random, this was planned, and the fact that they were shot at close range, that many wounds existed, the burnt female gorilla, all of this, although a mystery at the time that we discovered the bodies, plainly was not about a poaching incident.
So you were sure that somebody was sending a message to somebody else through executing these gorillas?
I was sure that a message was being sent here. We just weren't sure who was sending that message and what the rationale was behind the message.
Before we get to what you learned about who was sending the message and why, let's talk a little bit more about what happened in those executions. One of your photos from last July is of one of these large, magnificent mountain gorillas who has been executed with a large leaf over the genital area and another large leaf over the face. And I wasn't sure when I saw that photo how to read it. Was this, you know, how people cover the faces of humans when they die? Was this that kind of thing and covering the genital area almost out of respect for the gorilla's dignity or modesty or whatever? Was something else going on here?
Let me first qualify this entire incident in a certain context. I've been covering conflict in this region of the world for more than 10 years, and I've seen a fair amount of horror, but I've never seen that degree of stoicism or sobriety or somberness. I've never seen that displayed as much as I saw amongst the men who went to collect the gorillas, the bodies of these gorillas. It was a very sober affair. There was no talking. It was very quiet. For many moments at a time, the only thing you could hear was the sound of people walking. And normally when you put a bunch of African men together and they're involved in some degree of physical labor, no matter how traumatic that might be, there'll be some talking, there'll be some singing, there'll be some degree of conversation. That never happened on this occasion, and I've never seen that before. Even when people were collecting the bodies of humans, when I've seen massacre sites out there, I've never seen a reaction as quiet or as sobering as I did when they recovered these bodies. What you're seeing when you see the leaves on the animal's body is twofold. Okay, there are a group of men out there that will tell you that they covered the wounds of these animals out of respect. There's a certain spiritual element to that. And there's also the element of fluids will be leaking from these bodies during the transportation process. So there's a practical element to it. But I think that you could tell a lot about this practice when you consider the reverence in which it was done. The men that actually lashed these gorillas to these saplings for transportation did that very gently. When they placed the leaves in the wounds and around the genital areas, that occurred because there were wounds in those areas. And like I say, it was simply a combination of practicality and respect.
Well, you know, on your website, you have some photos that I don't think were published in either Newsweek or National Geographic. And one of them is of one of the gorillas before the gorilla was covered by the leaves, and you see genital wounds, and you see the face burned and disfigured, and mm-hmm. It makes the crime so much even more grotesque that the genitals and the face were intentionally burned and wounded.
Terry, I must tell you that the genital wound that you're talking about is actually, it's a machete wound that occurred with one of the females. It's a cut that sort of, it severs the main muscles of the leg joint. I don't know what was going on in the mind of the people who did this at the time, but it seems to have been a crime that it was done in order to build a greater anger. It was a power statement. All of the things that occurred.
When you say build an anger, you mean among the people who would witness this, who would see the remains.
Yeah. You know, obviously our investigation subsequent to the discovery of these animals pointed to why this occurred. But when we discovered the bodies initially, it was very much, it seemed to be something that was done for no good reason other than to further humiliate and denigrate the bodies of these creatures.
These creatures who are an endangered species right now, there's only about 700 of them who still survive. How did you come upon the scene? I mean, it's amazing that you were there with your camera.
Well, I must credit Newsweek for having the foresight to want to do this story. Scott Johnson is the Newsweek bureau chief for Africa, and he and I worked on the story together. We had wanted to cover this group of rangers who we felt were doing the most dangerous job in the world of conservation. You know, Virunga National Park right now has two rebel army factions and at least five different militia groups operating within the park. There's 650 rangers for the entire conservation area of Congo. These people receive very little money, and 110 of them have died in the last 10 years trying to do this job. So it really is an incredible labor of love. These are some of the most dedicated conservationists in the world, and they do so with no resources and very little help. The reason we chose this time was because our research had indicated that it was likely that there would be clashes between this group and militia groups in the park. A group of 50 specialized rangers, Congolese Conservation Authority rangers, had recently been sent to South Africa for specialized training in bush warfare. So our rationale for doing the story was that we would go to the park to accompany a group of these specialized rangers who would be in the park primarily to, you know, be in confrontational situations with these militia groups. And we wanted to see how that would play out.
Having no idea that what you would see was the results of the execution of six mountain gorillas.
We had no idea that the execution of the guerrillas would occur, but we did expect that there would be confrontation between the rangers and a militia group, and that was going to be the core of our story.
What was your reaction when you came on the scene?
Well, I was stunned at how sober this occasion was. I was just, you know, as I said to you, I've been working in the Congo since 1994, and I've seen some horrific things there. It is, you know, a place where value for human life is at an all-time low. So seeing how dark an occasion this was for these rangers was really, it was very enlightening for me. It also, frankly, I think was sort of the dawning of my own awakening as to the relationship between conservation and conflict and just, you know, the space that we are in with regards to some of our resources, whether they are animals or flora or fauna or whatever. It was, for me, definitely the first time where I really made the connection in my own mind between the fact that, yes, this was a conflict zone, but it didn't just involve humans.
My guest is photojournalist Bren Sturton. We'll talk more about his National Geographic cover story about the mountain gorilla massacre after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is photojournalist Bren Sturton, and he did the photos for the cover story of the new issue of National Geographic, and then there's a companion documentary that will be shown July 1st. And the cover story is called Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas, and it's about the execution-style murders of six mountain gorillas, an endangered species, in Virunga National Park in the Congo. Brent, you know, one of the amazing things about this story is it reveals how Virunga National Park has become a microcosm for the larger conflict in the area. The conflict has spilled over the border of the park into the heart of the park. There's a Hutu militia, a Tutsi militia, Congolese army, all operating from within the park, and other militias as well. And it sounds like the Congolese army, or at least many members of the army, are very corrupt and do what they want to do to make money from whichever militia is going to give it to them. Mm-hmm. And the militias are exploiting the resources in the park and using it for their private trade, making a fortune off of it, ruining the park in the process. How did the militias end up in the park after the Rwandan genocide?
What's happening in the park goes back further than a decade. It goes back to the 1994 Rwandan genocide. When that genocide concluded, the people responsible for the genocide were chased into the Congo, into the Goma region, and set up in a camp of more than 1 million people. In amongst that 1 million people were the hardcore Genesse Des, the people responsible for the genocide. 8,000 of those people still remain in Virunga National Park today. Allied against those people today are the CNDP under General Laurent Nkunda, who are the opposing army against those Hutu militia groups. In the middle of that, you have to add the Congolese army, who are in relations with the Hutu militia groups and in opposition to General Laurent Nkunda at this time. But there has been collusion between all these militia groups. In 1995, those Hutu militias entered into business relationships with members of the Congolese army. And I must point out that not all members of the Congolese army are corrupt. There are some good men. But it is a place of extreme poverty. So any kind of business opportunity that presents itself is likely to be jumped upon. One of the major business opportunities, for Virunga, is the illegal charcoal industry. Virunga is the only source of hardwood trees in the area. Hardwood trees produce great charcoal. It burns longer. It burns hotter. And charcoal is the primary fuel of this region. So since 1995, members of the FDLR Hutu militia groups, the Hutu extremists who were responsible for the genocide in Rwanda, those members in Virunga have been in cahoots with members of the Congolese army and with businessmen in Goma and engaged in an illegal charcoal industry. It's very difficult for the rangers to combat that industry because obviously it's a dangerous activity to get involved in.
So by cutting down these old hardwood trees to make charcoal, mm-hmm. part of Virunga Park is basically being ruined.
These are ancient forests, okay? So people say, well, can't you just replant? Well, no, actually, because you're altering the sustainability of the entire region. You're changing the water basin. You're changing the entire pattern by which this ecosystem operates. You know, when you fly over Virunga and you look down, there are enormous tracts of destruction. And, you know, those areas, unfortunately, are gone forever. So what I think the rangers of Virunga are trying to do at this stage is simply trying to preserve as much as they can until a more peaceful time where it might be possible to try to grow some of these areas again in the long term.
How does the relationship between the park rangers who are trying to save the forest and save the mountain gorillas, their relationship to the militias, how does that come in helping to explain the execution of the mountain gorillas? You said before that you knew somebody was sending a message to somebody through mm-hmm. these executions of the mountain gorillas. Having mm-hmm. gone back, who do you think now was sending a message to who?
The people behind the illegal charcoal operations in Virunga National Park are the people behind the guerrilla killings. There's no doubt in my mind about that, and all avenues of our investigation have led us to that conclusion. The charcoal industry in Virunga National Park occurs between members of the Goma business community, members of the FDLR Hutu Interahamwe forces, members of General Laurent Nkunda's CNDP militia forces, and local businessmen keen to exploit the park in any way that they can. All of those people are complicit in the illegal charcoal industry. That charcoal industry decimates the park, but it's also worth an average of $30 million in arguably one of the world's poorest regions. So it's an industry where there is no industry. It's an economy where there is no economy. So there's a great momentum to maintain that. What essentially happened was that a group of very concerned, very courageous, very ethical park rangers discovered that the chief supervisor of the park, a man called Onere Moshigiru, was in fact involved in directing the illegal charcoal operations. We believe that the guerrillas were killed in an attempt to discredit the conservation rangers who were against the illegal charcoal industry. And we believe that the guerrillas were killed as a power statement by that illegal charcoal lobby in order to say to the ethical rangers, we can do whatever we like. And if you interfere in our business, this is the kind of thing that will happen.
Now, you were the first photojournalist allowed back in the area of the park where the mountain gorillas live. How were you able to get in?
We had been waiting to go back in for a while, and we were repeatedly told by various conservation organizations in the region that it would be impossible to go there. And there is some truth to that statement, but myself and National Geographic writer Mark Jenkins, we decided that, immediately after the latest peace treaty was signed in January of 2008, that it would be a good time to try and go and see if we could get inside. So we went back to the Democratic Republic of Congo. We went to the Goma region, and we arranged to see General Laurent Nkunda. Now, General Laurent Nkunda is the head of the CNDP, which is the militia group, the rebel army group, which currently occupies the guerrilla sector of Virunga National Park. They have occupied that sector since August of 2007, and they have excluded the Congolese conservation authorities from that area since then.
So this is basically right shortly after the executions of the mountain guerrillas, this militia group moved in and took control of the area where the mountain guerrillas live. So it's been closed off to the rest of the world.
It has been, yes. What I should point out is that there has been active conflict in the Congo. The most recent conflict in the Congo took place from August 2007. The majority of that fighting happened between Laurent Nkunda's CNDP militia group, the FDLR Hutu Interahamwe group, who are their sworn enemies, and the Congolese army, who have also been fighting against General Nkunda's CNDP group. That fighting concluded in January 2008, and since that time, no conservation authority has been allowed to operate within the guerrilla sector. So all we knew was that the guerrilla sector was occupied by this rebel group, but no contact had been possible. The rangers who had traditionally looked after the guerrillas had been excluded from that sector, and no one essentially knew what the future was or what the status quo was with regards to the remaining mounted guerrillas in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So myself and National Geographic writer Mark Jenkins, we decided we would go to Congo, and we made an appointment to go and see General Laurent Nkunda.
Brent Sturton will be back in the second half of the show. He took the photos for the July National Geographic cover story, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? You can see his photos on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new tribute to Keith Jarrett's quartet from the 70s by drummer George Schuller. And we continue our conversation with photojournalist Brent Sturton about the massacre of six mountain gorillas and the people responsible for it. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with photojournalist Brent Sturton. 1 year ago, he witnessed and photographed the discovery of six mountain gorillas who were massacred in their sanctuary, the Congo's Virunga National Park. His photo in Newsweek of a murdered 500-pound silverback being carried out of the park, tied on his back to a stretcher of saplings, brought global attention to the story. Sturton recently returned to the park, along with reporter Mark Jenkins, to investigate who was behind the gorilla massacre. They have the cover story in the new edition of National Geographic. In order to get into the part of the park where the mountain gorillas live, they had to get the permission of the militia leader who has controlled that sector of the park since shortly after the massacre. When we left off, Sturton said he and Jenkins went to the Congo and made an appointment to see the militia leader, General Nkunda. Can you just, like, make an appointment to see this this fearsome militia leader who has been accused of war crimes, including massacres, rape, and the forcible recruitment of child soldiers? You could just set up an appointment with him?
Well, like most military leaders, they'd like to put their own spin on things. They'd like to manipulate the media in any way they can to their advantage. They'd like to put their own point of view across. And, you know, I think there's a degree of ego to any encounter with the media when it comes to powerful people. I think that Mr. Nkunda was aware of the fact that he'd had some bad public relations already on the guerrilla issues. So we wanted to give him a chance to put his point of view across, and we said so. Then so Mark and myself, we got in a vehicle and we drove to the area where he was apparently based. And we set up a series of phone calls and go-betweens. And we were eventually taken to his base in a in an area of the Democratic Republic of Congo called Kiriliwe in the eastern provinces of Congo. And we went up and had a lunch with the guy and, you know, sat down and asked him his opinions on what was going on in the guerrilla sector. He reassured us that he was very pro-conservation and very concerned about the that the right information regarding his troops and the guerrillas was out there. He had been very concerned about the guerrilla issue because in January of 2007, it was reported that CNDP troops, his troops, had in fact shot and eaten a mountain guerrilla. So, you know, he was, General Arnold Kunda was obviously very keen to repair whatever public relations damage had occurred with regards to his troops and the mountain guerrilla issue.
Do you believe him? Do you believe him when he says that they're protecting the mountain guerrillas?
Well, let me explain what happened when we got there. In the course of our interview with General Nkunda, he reassured us that everything being was that was possible to protect the guerrillas was being done, and that the conservation authorities, the Congolese conservation authorities, would welcome back at any time, and he would protect them. But what was contradictory about that statement was that at exactly the same moment that we were conducting that interview, members of the ICCN, which is the Congolese Conservation Authority, were visiting Bunagana and trying to see the people who had taken over this illegal parallel administration, this illegal group of rangers who were now looking after the mountain guerrilla sector under Nkunda's regime. When they had tried to go in there and talk to them, General Nkunda's second in command had threatened those rangers with execution and told them emphatically that if they had not come with UN protection, they would have been executed on the spot. So for me, that means that anything that General Laurent Nkunda has to say has to be taken with quite a large pinch of salt.
Now, you took a photograph that's published in the current National Geographic of General Nkunda, the leader of this militia, and it's quite a photo. I mean, he's sitting on a wooden chair in the middle of the park. There's, like, nothing around him except, like, grass and trees, and he's seated on this chair. The only other thing around him is a lot of armed guards with automatic weapons acting as his bodyguards.
Mm-hmm.
He's wearing sunglasses, a dark suit, an immaculate white shirt with cufflinks, white socks, black shoes, and he has a very elegant cane that he's leaning on that has like a silver tip that looks like it's in the shape of a snake head or a bird's head.
It's an eagle head, isn't
it? An eagle head, okay. Mm-hmm. And it's quite an elegant photo. I mean, it's kind of like the GQ of the militia world, you know. So can you talk a little bit about taking this incredibly elegant photo of this brutal militia leader who's accused of being a war criminal?
Well, I think that you have to understand that General Nkunda is very aware of his public image.
I figured, yeah.
You know, I've seen him in a number of different outfits, everything from a Desert Storm outfit to an American Marine outfit to wearing his American Stetson and looking like a cowboy to a purple hip-hop tracksuit. So this suit was only his latest manifestation. What was interesting about this interview is that when I called him the general, you know, he said, no, I'm the chairman now. And Mark, the geographic writer, had asked him, you know, what's next for you, Mr. Chairman? And he looked at us and said, yeah, Kinshasa. Now, Kinshasa is the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's a direct reference to his political aspirations. So I think that when it comes to Jerome Nkunda, he thinks very carefully about how he presents himself to the media. But at the same time, he does definitely enjoy the attention. And he's not unaware of the fact that geographic has tremendous reach. And I think he thought very seriously about what he wanted to wear for that day.
It looks it. It definitely looks like he thought about it. Did he give you any advice about how he wanted to be represented or what he would or wouldn't allow you to do when shooting him?
Well, you know, the thing is that from a purely practical point of view, there's a house on a hill and then there's a landscape. And General Nkunda is all about the appropriation of land. Here's a man who wants to carve out a space for himself, not only in terms of history, but in terms of physical space. So it made a lot of sense for me to put him in a landscape that he has essentially like appropriated. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that's around him doesn't belong to him. It's simply there because of the force of his militia group. You know, exactly the same as his presence in the guerrilla sector. I mean, he has no right to be there whatsoever. There's no legal precedent whatsoever for his occupation. It is illegal. And only through his force is he able to be there, and only through the support of Rwanda, who is his patron, is he able to be in that sector. So I guess that in making that picture, you know, it's not a picture that I have a lot of time to make, but I guess I'm trying to hint at those elements.
The head of this militia told you that you had his permission, you and the writer for National Geographic, Mark Jenkins, that you had the militia leader's permission to go to where the mountain gorillas lived in the section mm-hmm. of the park that the militia leader now controls and look for yourself and look at how his men treat the mountain gorillas. He neglected to tell you that the road you had to take to get there was mined.
That's correct, yes.
How did you find out that it was mined?
The reason Mark and I really, you know, were wary about this road, let's put it this way. We drove to this area, we were dropped off by our driver, and we then started to walk up this road. Now, I've walked up this road before, the previous year, and this is an area that's normally heavily populated, and there's lots of people around, etc. And when we began walking up this road, it was very quick, and we were very quick to see that there's no one. And that the road was completely overgrown. It hadn't been used. All of those things sort of make you start thinking. So we could have walked a quarter of the way up this road. And, you know, we were careful. We walked along the sides of the road. And we weren't sure whether this place was mined or not. But we decided that it was probably a bad idea. So we walked back down the road, retracing our steps. And we walked to the local mission. Now, the local mission is occupied by the United Nations peacekeepers at this time. And, you know, they confirmed for us that, yes, they thought the road was mined. But they couldn't be sure. The only time we actually found out that the road was definitely mined was by the time we'd finished working in the guerrilla sector. But let me first say that we went through this old mission where the UN was operating. They couldn't quite believe that we wanted to go up and see this rebel group, but They didn't feel like they could stop us. So Mark and I walked up this mountain that was behind the group, behind this mission, and got to the top of the first series of hills and were promptly arrested by a group who we had been informed by General Nkunda and his immediate area commanders that this group would be expecting us. Unfortunately, that particular command had not been translated or certainly passed on to any of the sentries. So we were arrested and marched off to the local area commander, about an hour away from this area where we were arrested. Once we got to this base, they made a couple of calls, and everyone ascertained that, yes, we were indeed supposed to be there, and that this local area commander should host us and direct us to the guerrillas the following day.
My guest is photojournalist Brent Sturton. We'll talk more about his National Geographic cover story about the Mountain Gorilla Massacre after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photojournalist Brent Sturton. He and reporter Mark Jenkins have the cover story in the new edition of National Geographic magazine. It's about who's responsible for last summer's massacre of six mountain gorillas in their sanctuary, the Congo's Virunga National Park. The area of the park where the gorillas live is now controlled by a militia. So the leader of this militia told you that his men believed in conservation and they were watching over and protecting the mountain gorillas.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got to the part of the park where the mountain gorillas live, what kind of interaction did you see between the men from the militia and the mountain gorillas?
Well, I should explain that General Laurent Nkunda has appointed a member of his extended family, a warden, Kana, who is now in charge of the parallel administration that General Nkunda has established to look after or supposedly look after these gorillas. But I would have to say that Warden Kana is someone who had had a bad record with the conservation authority in the Congo prior to this occupation. He is someone who had previously deserted his post and had only reappeared on the gorilla protection scene once General Laurent Nkunda actually overtook the gorilla sector and occupied it. There was also a number of seven or eight rangers who this warden Kana said he was working with at the time. None of these rangers are people who had spent significant time with the gorillas previously. In my prior work in the gorilla sector, none of the rangers who were actually an authority on gorilla protection were still working in the park. Those men had been chased out by Nkunda's troops, and these lesser authorities placed in authority instead of them. So when Mark and myself went to see the gorillas with Nkunda's men, at a certain point on our patrol into the forest, we came to Warden Kana, who was waiting for us, and he took us into the forest along with this patrol of 40-odd militiamen, and we then walked for a two-hour period into the bush. Very thick, very hot. Not an easy thing to do to see the gorillas in the Congo. But what was really striking and alarming for me is that when we finally got to see these gorillas, the militiamen were far more concerned about using their cell phones and their small digital cameras to take photos of themselves with the gorillas than they were about observing what is the correct protocols when it comes to gorilla safety. I should explain that disease is transmitted really easily between humans and gorillas. And what we consider to be minor diseases, for example, influenza, can be fatal to gorilla families. And bear in mind that there are just over 700 surviving mountain gorillas in the world today. So when Mark and myself go into the bush with this kind of militia out there and we see that this militia group gets within 2 meters of the mountain gorillas, that's just not acceptable at all.
So even if their intentions are good, even if they really want to help the gorillas, they're not trained in how to do that, and they can unintentionally kill them just through spreading their germs by getting too close.
Absolutely.
So
also, I would point out that the rangers that are traditionally in charge of looking after these gorillas have been doing that for 15 or 20 years in most cases. They are trained to see what the dynamics are within the families. They're trained to make sure that there's not too much gorilla-human interaction or contact. They're trained in recognizing whether there's any diseases present in the gorilla groups, whether there's any wounds, what needs to be done, how they need to be treated. I mean, these people are experts. And they're experts because they spent years doing this incredibly difficult job. And they're experts because of the level of dedication they bring to that job. So, you know, it's not enough to turn around and say, oh, well, we're protecting the gorillas now. For Nkunda to make that statement is ridiculous.
I bet the park rangers who have protected and watched over the mountain gorillas for so many years and have now been forced out by the militia that controls the area, I bet they're very upset because they've become so emotionally attached to the gorillas by observing and protecting them for so many years.
The average statement you would hear from the people, from the conservation rangers that have spent the most time with the gorillas, is they feel they have been separated from their families. That's how closely they see their relationship with these gorilla populations. And, you know, it's a fact. I've spent time with the conservation rangers who are the legitimate gorilla authorities. I've seen how they interact with these gorillas. I've seen the fact that the gorillas are accustomed to having them around, that they're comfortable having them around, that there's a certain understanding that exists between these animals and these rangers. Then I've spent time with rangers who are now in a position where they're supposed to be observing these gorilla groups, and I've seen how afraid they are, how nervous they are on the gorillas. I've seen how agitated the gorillas are, how nervous the gorillas are. It's not a calm and easy relationship.
The area of the world that you're documenting through your photographs now on National Geographic, Virunga National Park in the Congo, this is an area in which, what, about 5 million people have been killed in the past few years in conflict. It's a huge amount. You know, the Rwanda genocide happened in this area right across the border. And yet, you know, you bring the mountain gorillas into the equation, and somehow it brings a new level of attention to the story. Have you thought a lot about that? Why is it 5 million people have been killed? There's 700 mountain gorillas. Six of them were executed in one day a year ago. And that brought just a global attention to this story. Can you talk a little bit about your reflections on how the mountain gorillas brought a new level of attention after so many millions of people were killed?
Sure. The most surreal aspect for me is the fact that we have been covering the human atrocity elements of what's been happening in the Congo for a long time. And, you know, we've published some very harrowing stories, and it continues to be a place where, you know, some of the most barbaric human rights abuses in our world are occurring on a daily basis. So the fact that the pictures of the dead mountain gorillas elicited the attention that they did, you know, that was a surreal moment for me, because I haven't quite put my finger on it, but I think that the general psychology behind it is that when you start talking about millions in terms of human death, there's a certain head in the sand thing that happens to us as human beings. Our sense of collective responsibility is diluted by this sheer number of people. When it starts becoming an issue of millions of people dead, then I think we have a tendency, you know, as a civilization to avoid responsibility because we feel, you know, there's nothing we can do about those kinds of numbers. It's too big, too daunting. But when you talk about a fragile mountain gorilla population, which for some reason there's an incredible interaction that occurs between human beings and these gorillas. You know, they are second only to chimpanzees in terms of DNA patterns. So they are essentially the closest animal on the planet to us, bar one. I think that when you start talking about smaller numbers, people feel that, yes, there might be some possibility to do something. For me personally, I'm just happy to see that attention is focused on this region in general. Yes, I want something done about this mountain gorilla population, no question. I think something can be done. But I also hope that these animals can work as a symbol for what's wrong with the region and can draw greater attention to that. And, you know, in a perfect world, form some sort of mechanism whereby people can start to think more rationally about what they're doing to each other in this part of the world.
There's so much at stake now in the Virunga National Park. You've got the lives of the remaining mountain gorillas. You've got, I think, millions of refugees living in the park and around the border. You've got ongoing conflict between militias and the Congolese army. You've got the basically rape and pillaging of the forest itself for personal profit. So is there anything you think the international community could do to help save the people, the gorillas, and the park itself?
I think that the best thing that the international community could do would be to try to enforce better government in this region of the world. I think that essentially you must recognize that there are two militia armies in Virunga National Park, and those armies exist because, one, the FDLR Interahamwe Hutu guerrillas need to be allowed back into Rwanda for proper due process. Certain guarantees need to be in place by the Rwandan government in order to make that happen. I think that should go ahead and that there should be some resolution and have them out of the forest as quickly as possible. I think that when it comes to General Laurent Nkunda and his influence in the guerrilla sector, I think again that the U.S. State Department could put sufficient pressure on the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, to either pull him out of that sector or at the very least allow the proper conservation authorities back into that region. I think that the total appropriation of that resource is not acceptable at all. And I believe that the U.S. has strong relationships with Rwanda, a strong trade relationship with Rwanda. And as a result of that, there is possible influence.
Well, Brent Sturton, thank you very much for talking with us. And, you know, good luck with your continued travels and your work.
Thank you very much, Terry. Thank you for having me on this show.
Brent Sturton took the photos for the new National Geographic magazine cover story, Who Murdered the Mountain Gorillas? You can see Sturton's photos on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD saluting Keith Jarrett by George Schuller. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's heartened by a recent movement on the part of musicians, bloggers, and critics to rehabilitate the much maligned jazz of the 1970s. A case in point, Kevin says, is the new album from drummer George Schuller, saluting pianist Keith Jarrett's American Quartet of the 70s.
Here's George Schuller's idea in a nutshell. Play some of those catchy tunes Keith Jarrett wrote in the 1970s, and play that pianist music without a piano. And then, without advertising it or putting on platform shoes, playing it all in a 70s kind of way. George Schuller's quintet is called Circle Wide, which could describe their breezy approach to playing tunes that have a way of looping back on themselves. It's especially nice to hear them now that composer Jarrett doesn't play them anymore. Schuller's tribute album is called Like Before, Somewhat After. Keith Jarrett wrote his tunes here for his 1970s American Quartet, and sometimes tenor saxophonist Donnie McCaslin and bassist Dave Ambrosio take on the roles of the Jarrett Band's Dewey Redman and Charlie Hayden. Arranging this material, George Schuller considers the broader context of Keith Jarrett's American Quartet. The icy new Scandinavian jazz announced by members of his other European quartet of the 70s, and the pianist's occasional collaborations with percussionists, guitarist Sam Brown, and vibist Gary Burton, all but channeled here by Tom Beckham. Schuller also wrote a couple of tunes that aim for Jarrett's easy grace. Thank you. That's the band's secret weapon, the crafty, creative, and very versatile guitarist Brad Shepik. He gets plenty of play and often steals the show. Shepik slides into the guitar universe of 70s icons like John McLaughlin and Norway's Terje Rypdal with their echoes of the North Indian sitar. George Shuler's crew evokes soloists of the time to honor an undervalued period in jazz, which did have its excesses, like the odd endless ending. They have a little fun with 70s shticks without spoiling a joke by calling attention to it.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Circle Wide, the new CD by drummer George Shuler's quintet on the Playscape label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Rhino with the Glue-On Shoes and other surprising true stories of zoo vets and their patients. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Because she is a brain scientist, Jill Bolte Taylor is able to describe in depth what happened to her when she suffered a stroke that left her unable to walk, talk, read, write, or remember her life. It took 8 years to recover. In her new book, My Stroke of Insight, she writes from her perspective as a brain scientist and stroke victim. Join us for the next Fresh Air.